Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk about research, scholarship, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very delighted today to be talking with my friends and my own scholastic mentors, Joan M. Ferrante and Robert W. Hanning, emeritus professors of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. They are each the authors of voluminous books and articles on English, Italian, German, French, and Latin medieval literature and literary history. I'm with them to talk about their most recent shared project, their co-authoring of an English translation of the medieval French antique romance, The Romance of Thebes, just published by the Arizona Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies. Joan has kindly offered to host our conversation in her apartment here on Riverside Drive in New York. Hello, Joan and Bob.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for welcoming me into your wonderful apartment here. Having
me
here. Beautiful view of the Hudson you have. You're both professors emeriti now, since your retirements a few years back, so perhaps the lesson is that there is, for some, academic life after retirement. But your history with the university for each of you stretches back also before you received your first teaching appointments here at Columbia. So there was life before you were professors, although, again, Columbia figures in both the before and after for the two of you. So I wonder if you could each possibly talk a bit about your backgrounds and the place that Columbia has in your lives before, after.
Mine goes back to age three because my mother worked at the law school and she taught Italian and general studies, so I was around the university from time to time when I was little and able to use the library even in prep school.
A Columbia blue diaper baby.
That's right. And I went 1 year to Harvard as an undergraduate and hated it and then came back to Barnard and then went on to graduate school. So I'm a very provincial Columbia type, I guess. I can't say that I've ever had any love for the university. I had wonderful students and I had wonderful medieval colleagues, but a lot of trouble with the administration and with other colleagues, and so it's been a love-hate relationship all along. But they are now running my database on medieval women's correspondence through the Center for Medieval Teaching and Learning, I think, CCNMTL, and that I do appreciate, having that and the library.
Of course, I can't say I was involved with Columbia that early. I grew up in Brooklyn. My father was a graduate of a dental school, which subsequently became the Columbia Dental School. So I grew up knowing about that. And at some point, fairly early in my life, I guess, I formed the notion that I would like to go to Columbia. Mm-hmm. And I remember going with my parents to a football game when I was still in high school and having Dwight Eisenhower, who was then the president of the university, sign my football program, which I have long since lost. But in any case, yes, I came to Columbia. I was only 16 when I entered the freshman class, the class of 1958, and with the exception of 2 years off for good behavior in Oxford, I guess I've been at Columbia almost ever since. Occasionally I was able to go off for a term to another place to teach as a guest, which gave me a sense of other air. But yeah, Columbia, Columbia, Columbia. Uh-huh. And with Joan, I have the same kind of mixed sentiments. That is, I loved the teaching from the day one to the end, and I had colleagues, starting, of course, with Joan, whom I was very fond of, many of whom I could never convince to come and have lunch with me, not because they didn't like me, but because they were all so busy. There's something about the place that got in the way of what I felt to be basic, necessary socializing. In any case, and as far as the administration goes, we found plenty of ways to be at cross purposes with the administration. And Joan especially was much more courageous than I was about saying that. Occasionally I would get up enough courage to join her in that. And that didn't make us any friends. So yeah, I once toyed with the idea if I ever wrote a memoir about myself, there would be a long chapter about Columbia that would be called Morningside Heights and Depths. Needless to say, I never wrote it. Yeah, and now, of course, I'm still very much at Columbia because I do a lot of pro bono adult education teaching that has me on the campus all the time, though it has absolutely nothing to do with my old department or with the university administration. It's my work with the adults who come from all over the city, who've never finished high school, who want to go on to college when they get their high school equivalency. And so I keep teaching and I keep enjoying it. And it's still at Columbia, at least.
And that program is an outreach program?
Columbia has a community service organization called Columbia Community Impact. And within that, there are many services that involve volunteers. Many of them are undergraduates volunteering to help children in the neighborhood or adults. Very worthwhile. But the largest program they have is an adult education program that requires more than undergraduate volunteers, because we're actually teaching people how to get their high school diploma, and in my case, how to go on beyond that to college. So that every term I teach a 6-week college prep course, as I call it, that's designed to introduce the people I'm working with to what college is like and introduce them to some of the skills that they're going to need in order to succeed at college, not just to get in, but to stay in and to thrive. And we've started other programs as well, of which my favorite is what we call Core and Community, that brings 3 Columbia professors who teach in the core curriculum, who come as volunteers each term, to give a 90-minute sample class using a snippet of a text from the core curriculum, and giving our students, our adult students, a sense of what it's like to sit in a classroom with a college professor and think seriously about the large issues that the core curriculum is supposed to raise. And my favorite comment in all the years I've been working with this was at one point, in response to a question that one of the instructors asked, one of my adult students said, "I'll have to think about that." And that struck me as exactly what I'm looking for. Yeah. I'm looking for people who are willing to think about it before they confront the serious questions, not necessarily of Western literature, but of their lives and of the life of the country. Yeah. So better citizens is the secret ingredient of what I'm after in this program.
Since a little before we retired, I've been working on this database that has the lives of women for whom we have letters either to or from, and the Latin text of the letters and then translations, most of them done by me, but not all. The database, the name is Epistolae, L-A-E, and if anybody wants to look at it. And we now have, 230 women or something and about 2,300 letters so far in there. Continues to grow, and people, historians, apparently use it all over the country in their courses. And some of them have told me it's their students' favorite resource. And I get hits from Europe and Australia and various places. So it's a resource that's an ongoing thing.
And it's a magnificent achievement, which Joan is too modest to say, but I would like to say that it is.
Yeah. There isn't much printed, is there, in terms of letters?
Most of what we've got in here is the Latin texts are available, but they're available often in the collections of men's letters that the women corresponded with. And they were kept that way. There were very few collections of women's, actually only 2 that I know of, women's letters per se.
Sounds wonderful. Bob, you mentioned the core curriculum. The core curriculum seemed to me, as a graduate student at Columbia, to define everything that went on, even at the graduate level, let alone the undergraduate level, and that it was about ideas, and it was about talking about literature in terms of ideas, and there was kind of excitement about it. I mean, I expected, and maybe wrongly so, a sort of professional training at the graduate level where we'd all be trained to be editors, you know, and somebody have a manuscript in the bottom drawer, they pull it out and they, you know, say, well, why don't you look at this for publication? But happily, it wasn't that kind of training. It was a reason for us to engage ideas and engage the literature in a way that, I don't know how to put this quite, but where we were pulled into this kind of world of intellectual excitement and community. You both created a wonderful medieval community. No, you did.
Medieval
community, yes. I mean, a community of medievalists around you, with a medieval guild particularly, that drew people in from not just the campus, but from outside the campus. I mean, people would come to...
I think we were happy to do that. I certainly always enjoyed it. Yeah. Let me go back, however, and say that among the, not many, but several issues on which Joan and I do not see eye to eye, I think it's important to state that core curriculum is not one. Neither of us, I would like to say, are fanatical devotees of the core curriculum in the sense that it has to be seen as the defining experience, which Columbia would like to see.
The canon,
I think there's a real danger there of the fetishizing of the core curriculum, so that we both have different kinds of reservations about it. But purely as a pragmatic thing, in order for me to get my adult students in a situation where they're being asked, they're not sitting in a corner and being talked at by some expert, but rather being asked to think seriously about issues that ultimately do concern them as human beings, as citizens, and et cetera, et cetera. The core curriculum is useful because it does, for instance, the very first one of these 10 years ago that we did, someone came in and talked about Pericles' funeral oration, which gave us a chance to talk about, on the one hand, democracy, and on the other hand, what kind of a democracy is it where the women are left out?
Yes, you know. Yeah.
Well, this past year we had Epicurus. We had someone talking about Epicurus, and we've had Russian specialists. Usually the person who comes in is a specialist in the area that they are talking about, though that's not the way the core curriculum works. But the main thing, as I say, is the pragmatic thing of giving them. It's not presented, at least I don't present it, as an advertisement for Columbia's core curriculum. Yeah. Because the chances are very much that none of the people I'm working with is ever going to end up taking those courses. Yeah. Although some of them do end up in Columbia School of General Studies, yeah. I'm happy to say, which are, as time went on, I was increasingly happy to teach the students.
Well, that's where I started until Joan asked me if I might be interested in the PhD program.
Yeah. So General Studies is very much on the screens, perhaps more so than it should be in the sense that it becomes an object of desire for people when we keep telling them there are plenty of other. The City University has wonderful colleges, including community colleges, which you can get into without a special examination. If you do well enough on the high school equivalency test, if you reach a certain score, you automatically have entrance into one of the community colleges. And that's the word go. What you do after that is going to be up to you.
And of course, Joan was known for inserting women into the so-called canon.
I never taught the core curriculum.
No.
Oh, you never did? Oh, that's interesting.
In my day, they didn't want women in it. And by the time they wanted women, I said, nothing doing. I didn't approve of it. I consider it an intellectual fake because it is taught by people who don't have the languages, who don't have the historical context, not even usually the critical context, who think they can... Now, this is not true of Bob.
Yeah.
And by and large, it's not true of a lot of the graduate students who teach it, who work really hard to fill in their gaps and I think do a better job than the seniors. But the seniors think they know how to read and they can teach anything. Yeah. And I've never approved of that. But that's my
That generation, to a certain extent, now has passed
has gone.
Away.
They're
I will
dead.
Say that. Yes. And it is also true that many of the people that we get are precisely... advanced graduate students or beginning assistant professors.
Yeah, that
in my particular corner.
Where I brought women into the curriculum was in medieval studies.
Yes, and Joan, of course, was an absolute pioneer, a stalwart pioneer in that, for which we are all very grateful indeed.
Both of you have taught both graduate students, undergraduates. Do you have any thoughts about teaching that aspect of your careers and your engagement with your students? You both loved your students, I could tell that.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of them loved you, so.
I taught mostly graduate students because of the nature of the courses I was teaching. Yeah. Provençal and medieval allegory and things like that. So they were mostly graduate, although occasionally undergraduates would take them.
Yeah.
And then in the last... 10, 12 years of my teaching career, I taught a course in women, religion, and human rights.
Uh-huh.
Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and the problems they made for women, that these religions made for women, and the way women could, from within the religion, deal with it in order to do what they wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
And that was an undergraduate course.
Interesting.
So that was different. That was very interesting.
Yeah, I, on the other hand, of course, having been an undergraduate at Columbia, I had always... certain sense, I wouldn't say a soft spot, but a certain sense of obligation, and always did enjoy teaching undergraduates, though I must confess, and this is one of the peculiarities of my career, the atmosphere, if you will, in the English department at least, and I think in other places as well, among certain of the senior professors, is that teaching undergraduates was the only really good thing to do, that graduate students were somehow an inferior lot and to be tolerated, but where the real, as Lionel Trilling once said, the real joy is for older men to teach younger men and then go out and encounter women as the other. My quoting that, which is an accurate quote, got me in a lot of trouble at one point, but it's still not, it remains true. Anyway, the point is that because of that, in my callow youth, I sort of bought some of that. And I resisted teaching graduate students at the beginning of my career on the feeling that somehow they wouldn't be as good. Well, thank God, at some point somebody threw me into the water, and not only did I learn to swim, but I learned that was the best water to be in. Yeah. So that for the greater part of my career, the real joy was teaching graduate students. Though I always taught undergraduates. And here again, an interesting parallel with Joe. In the last 17 years of my career, I invented and taught a course on race and racism in American literature.
Was anybody else at Columbia teaching this?
Well, I'm sure there was also an established Institute for African American Studies, which was training PhDs and so on, and they had a specialist. Yeah. So there were, of course, there were specialists teaching in various areas, but that's what they were doing. They were teaching specialist courses. What I felt was lacking, and it had to do with a racial incident that happened on campus in the late 1980s, what I discovered listening to the angry talk after that was there wasn't a basic attempt to get at the issue of race in America across groups. And so I, in my madness, I said, let me try to, as a medievalist, let me try to set this up. So I taught myself over a year and a half, got permission from the Committee on Instruction in Columbia College, created this course called Race and Racism, Literary Representations of an American Crisis, and taught it to almost every year for the last 16, 17 years of my career, in which at the level I specifically planned it as the equivalent of a core curriculum course. That is, a course, much to Joan's disapproval, was taught by someone who was not an expert in any way in any of the subjects, okay? But it was designed to introduce students to a large issue that then hopefully if they would follow in more, so that I dealt with not just the issues that slavery has saddled this country with from its day one, but not only African-American issues, but Native American issues, Asian-American issues, and Latina issues. In the course of a term, you can imagine what a skimming of the surface that was, but at least I was introducing them to the kinds of issues that had been real for people in all these groups, using texts and also documents. And no one else was doing that at the time, and no one else has done it since then. The course died with me. It was born with me,
my human rights,
and it's died with me. You would have thought that talk about one of the things we sort of hold against the university, not in the sense that we weren't celebrated for it, hell with that, but would have been nice if somebody had seen, this is worth doing, let's continue doing it. Nobody wanted to do it.
Let me say one thing about, because it's true of my human rights course too, that I was not by any means an expert in this field, but we both chose to do it with undergraduates, and we read furiously to fill in our gaps.
I read like crazy for a year and a half before.
Me too. I even tried to learn Arabic.
I remember reading Arabic in Kalamazoo.
So, you know, I mean, it's a little different, I think, from the
core. But it was something one felt one had to do.
Your graduate classes, just to reiterate something I've said on the radio before, they were like heaven to me. I mean, the other students were just absolutely wonderful, your students.
They were good students.
And Philosophy Hall, those seminar rooms were like little corners of paradise. I would go up there. They really were. The literature was just wonderful. We had brilliant people reading it that would come up with. The graduate students, they can be so brilliant. Okay, so let's dive into the text we're supposed to be talking about, the Romance of Thebes. It's an important work in the history of literary narrative, although not on the usual list of literary classics by readers of European literature, especially literature and translation. So the question is, what was your motive for devoting all this time jointly to this translation? And did you have, say, a readership in mind, or did you feel there was a gap here?
We were asked by somebody that Bob is very friendly with. I don't know her as well, but I have enormous respect and affection for her, Jocelyn Wogan Brown.
Oh, yes.
We were asked to do it.
So we
said, oh, all right.
Yeah, Jocelyn Wogan Brown, who's now a named professor at Fordham and about to retire, impoverishing us all because she will go back to living in Oxford, I think. Anyway, Jocelyn, whom I didn't know at all, I met at Vassar.
Oh, you did?
Yes,
oh.
There was a Berkshire Women's Conference at Vassar at the end of the 1980s or early in the 90s. I was up giving a response to some friend's paper, John Baldwin, actually, Jenny. I had time to kill, so I went to a session in which Jocelyn was talking, and I was so overcome by the brilliance of this woman. And also, she oozes generosity. Her brilliance is matched only by her generosity, which I have since then had numerous occasions to be the beneficiary of. So she was at the time teaching in Liverpool. And then she came to New York. She left Liverpool and came to New York to teach at Fordham. And I swooped down on her, invited her to have dinner at Faculty House, and recruited her for a little monthly group of medievalists that meets, which is modeled on an earlier group founded by Joan and our colleague Georgie Konomu that ran in this very room where we're sitting in the 70s and into the 80s. So using that as a model, I started a similar group, and I got Jocelyn into it. Anyway, Jocelyn's real claim to fame is taking an interest in what used to be called Anglo-Norman literature, mm-hmm. which, as I said earlier, she has renamed as the French of England, and she's become a constant salesperson of it, and she knows things backwards and forwards, amazing her knowledge. And as part of that, she started a series called the French of England Translation Series, mm-hmm. of which this is volume 11.
Yes.
The Romance of Thebes, and she asked us to do it, knowing that we had a previous stint of co-translation, and she respected us both, I think it's safe to say, mm-hmm. and asked if we would do it, and we said, yeah, we would do it. In an odd way, I came to feel, I don't know if you felt the same way, Joan, that we were not the right person to ask to do it. In terms of giving our all to do a translation the best we could, yes, we were, certainly. But many of the other volumes in this series, which are translations of a particular French of England text, are written by people who have specialized in that text and who can bring to it the full panoply of scholarly and... Yeah. Which we didn't. It's not... We knew the text, of course. We both taught it. Yeah. But we didn't consider it part of a specialty of ours. And so we saw it as a translation opportunity, let's put it that way, and a favorite to Jocelyn.
But we had both worked on and written about romances.
Yes, and certainly, exactly.
For me, the Statius as a part of my Dante work was, you know,
course.
So there were a lot of...
Yes, it wasn't that we'd never seen the damn thing before, but certainly, but it was really more, we were invited to do it and said, well, all right, let's do it. We haven't translated together for a while, let's do it again.
And there was no translation.
Yeah.
I mean, this didn't exist.
And the fact that, which will, I assume we'll speak more about, of the several manuscripts that are extant of this, there's only one which is insular,
which
was written in England, and therefore fell into the catchment of the French of England, which is why Jocelyn asked us to do it. If it had not been for that, it wouldn't be in the series. It's just because there is that one manuscript.
There was one aspect. I had written a little bit about the women in this, in the To the Glory of Her Sex.
Right.
I was interested in the way it brought women out.
It's interesting. We'll talk about that. Yeah. Also, you wrote about it in your book on the individual, just slightly.
Very slightly. I remember the passage, in fact. Yes, exactly.
We can talk about that, too, the kind of introduction of the courtly mentality into Statius.
Yeah, you're right. But that's really what it was. We were asked to do it, and we said, and I sometimes felt when we were wrestling with certain kinds of problems in the, especially in the editing process, and you know, questions would come up that we weren't really qualified. I wasn't. I couldn't speak for you. Qualified to fully to answer because I wasn't a scholar of this particular text.
But we had an editor who was.
We had an editor who was. Yes, and Jocelyn was able to.
Well, it reads so well. Just as a book for someone to pick up and read it as a narrative.
That's a real compliment.
Yeah, I mean, you can dive into it. It's like watching an action film. That's what it really is, but it has that feel about it.
Yes.
And you really get a sense of the time. So this isn't your first co-translation, however, of a romance or this kind of literature. You collaborated on a translation of a collection of Marie de France's Breton Lays back in 1978, a still popular edition of a great medieval author made available to English reading audiences. And actually, I just taught your translation of Marie's Biscarat, one of the lays in that work, in a first-year writing seminar at Vassar, which the students just loved, and they did all kinds of interesting things with. We did it for Halloween, actually, with a few other things that having to do with...
We watched
Bergman's Seventh Seal, and then we looked at Durer's Night, Death, and the Devil, so we were, you know, the same themes in all of them. So anyway...
May I interrupt for one second? Because after we did the translation, which was, of course, it had been translated more than half a century earlier.
Extremely inaccurately.
But I had thought about Biscarat because of my work on women and human rights and decided that there were all sorts of hints that suggested that it was about domestic violence and abuse, which I hadn't seen.
It's very enigmatic work.
It was his translation, but still, we worked on the comments.
Yeah, I had first made acquaintance with Marie in my first term at Oxford, where I was sent off to do a tutorial in Old French, which I had chosen as a subject of study, with a woman tutor at one of the women's colleges at St. Hilda. We didn't get along at all, largely because I was interested in what I would call literature, and she was interested in philology. So we agreed to part. I should say we agreed to part. She threw me out. First time that really happened, I was told at the end of a term, I never want to see you again. But I took away from that encounter a high regard for Marie and had read it all. And I guess at some point we were talking and...
It was Bob's idea to do this translation. You said it needs to be done and said to me, should we do it?
Yeah, and I remember I played around with one of the lays sitting on the subway, actually. So it was a lark. It was something we really enjoyed doing, and we took turns and looked at each other's work and read
the... But we should go back to the subway. We talked to a publisher about the possibility of publishing it, and on the way back on the subway, we sat down and said to each other, which ones would you like to do? And we had a list, and it was almost exactly opposite, so that was fine.
Okay.
But then we counted lines, and there was a discrepancy. Mm. So we made one shift, that's all we had to do, and we had our thing set up. And in a way, that serendipity of that was true of the way the whole work.
Absolutely.
So you split it up because it reads very smoothly.
Yeah, and then we had a certain amount of trouble looking for a publisher, and then it was finally published by a commercial publisher who didn't do a good job with it. I mean, they treated it more as a kind of coffee table book, which is not what we had in mind. And they dropped it almost immediately once. Fortunately, we were able to find ultimately two different in succession smaller presses that have kept it in print from that day to this, and I gather people still use it. There is at least one other translation of the lays in Penguin, but it's in prose, and that did not seem to us to be doing Marie the justice then.
Now, prose really changes, and that's true for the themes too, changes the way the thing works. The action of short lines is quite different.
So that was great fun.
Yeah.
And we had that in mind, of course, when we agreed to do this, which was not as much great fun, but because it's much longer.
Actually, the division of this, we decided, well, we'll do 2,000 lines each, and that will work out. Yeah. And then we had already begun, at least I guess I had begun maybe a little earlier, and Jocelyn said, oh, you're using the wrong text. You have to use this edition. Oh. So that changed the numbering of the lines.
Yes, that's true.
And then we had to
Even to the end, there are certain discrepancies of a line or two between the lineage of the translation and the lineage of manuscript S, which is the only one we had to concern. And Jocelyn tore her hair out a little bit about that, but it just stayed that way.
So she chose the edition.
So she chose the S manuscript?
Yes, it had to be, because that's the only one. From the beginning, that was the one we were going to deal with.
So can you talk then about the literary context of Thieves?
I'm tempted. Is it against the rules for me to read?
No, not at all. Yeah.
Put this together.
No, it's not.
Which, the way the introduction begins, is during the decades between 1150 and 1170, and within the Western European territory controlled by the Normans, which included, of course, more than Normandy and England, but after Henry II's marriage to Eleanor, the Duchy of Aquitaine as well, there arose a new type of narrative in the vernacular based on Latin texts inherited from classical antiquity. These Latin texts were endowed with historical and moral authority by those who studied them in the expanding network of 12th century monastic and cathedral schools, including the predecessors of the European University. The collective title given to the vernacular works by modern scholars is Romans Antiques or Roman d'Antiquité, the three primary examples being the Roman de Thèbes, the Roman d'Énéas, and the Roman de Troyes, based respectively on Statius, on Virgil's Aeneid, and on two late classical Latin translations of Greek texts ostensibly written by witnesses to the War of Troy, which of course they weren't at all. And now the whole question then of why, we'll never know, you can't answer a why question, but in fact it caught up in, and we talk about that a little bit on the next page as well, we say... Underlying the creation of the Romans Antiques is an intersection of the 12th century concepts of translatio studii and translatio imperii, the former translatio studii, a contention that the mantle of excellence in philosophy and other forms of learning, bunched in the French vernacular under the term clergy, had been passed across the centuries from Greece to Rome and then on to Christian Europe. The latter, translatio imperii, a similar assessment with respect to the westward transference of secular power and the martial prowess generalized as chivalry undergirding it. So you've got these two notions, and somehow Western Europe at this point, for a range of reasons that are ultimately economic and political and social, sees itself as the heir of these things.
Rome, obviously, because the Greek
had largely been lost, but they were fully aware. I mean, the very fact that they were writing about Troy, and they had that definitely in mind. And, of course, there were the legends that antedated the 12th century, did they not? That various European nations, as they formed into some kind of national or proto-national group, saw themselves as descended from this or that remnant of Troy or Rome.
Yeah, that's a genealogy.
So there was a lot of genealogical fictionalizing.
So do we know anything about the author of the Romance of Thebes?
Absolutely not.
Nothing.
No.
So the answer is no.
I would guess, I'd be curious, I think Joan agreed. That it wasn't written by some knight in armor. It's written by what we call a cleric, not meaning, you know, a priest or a bishop, but someone who had been educated in schools, largely schools that were under some kind of loose or not loose ecclesiastical control, in monasteries or cathedral schools people in those, people learn the texts of classical antiquity, and they began to think of them in terms of having a kind of moral authority. You have this tradition of what was called the acessus, that before a classical text, someone would have written an introduction that explained what were the moral lessons to be learned from what category. There were attempts to categorize and appropriate, one might say, the body of classical authority or Roman authority in a way that made it seem relevant. You know, it's like the Bible, it's like what the Greeks did with Homer. You have certain texts that achieve a certain sanctified category, and at the same time, you're remaking them so that they can really serve your own interests. It's a constant process of simultaneous worship and adaptation, right? Wouldn't you say it has to be both?
And
it can't be both.
The author has to have known enough Latin so that he could use the Tobiad Statius as the basis for this. But he's also clearly an imaginative poet because there are a lot of additions and more than tweaks of the characters and what they do. And it's the Dares thing is also injected into it.
That's fascinating.
So he's a poet in his own right.
Right, and he's familiar with the Crusades, clearly, places where he's thinking of the Crusades, and he's thinking about certain kinds of political issues, and as with this Dares episode that I'm sure we'll talk about, he's thinking from the outside, but also familiar with some of the kinds of crises and tensions within a certain moment that involves, on the one hand, traditions of lineage and blood and family, and on the other hand, centralizing political power and how these two things run against each other and create tensions.
And conflicts of loyalty.
And conflicts of loyalty. The idea of being loyal to your family is very deeply enshrined. How does that stack up with, how does that comport with
political
notions of political loyalty of some kind, even if they're less emotional and they are constrained by power? Yeah. You know
but
I mean?
Here there's also the added thing of the two princes at war with each other.
Yes.
And having loyalty to the one who is currently the king, but also having sworn an oath to that would enable the other one to take over. And Dares gets very much caught up in that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so do others.
And look, I mean, look what happens after you have William the Conqueror, who has sons who are at odds with each other, who hate each other. Each wants the realm and so on, so they fight each other, they don't behave. While at the same time, the notion of family and lineage loyalty remains, at some theoretical level, at least very important to them. But faced with who's going to get the power, that becomes... So the audience of this work would certainly be familiar with what has happened in this particular area over decades.
The loyalty comes in to family, comes in that particular family, is Henry I trying to set up his daughter as the heir to the kingdom.
That's Matilda, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So that's an interesting...
And as soon as he dies...
Matilda than anybody outside the
lineage. Right, and they all... his nobles all say they're going to do it, and as soon as he's dead,
they split.
He's a poet, but he's a poet who's working with materials that he's quite would see the resonances of which, let's say, put it that way.
Well, that comes into question. Is the audience the court here, then, to some extent? I mean, do we know who the audience was for the...
Presumably. The word court, I spent years and years and still find myself late at night wondering what that term really means, in the sense that we're dealing with a period in which the royal court, if by which you mean the king, his closest associates, and the people responsible for the treasury and and so on, they travel. They're in constant motion,
so it's a much larger
and
circle.
As they move around, wherever they're going to be, they're going to attract other people.
Yep.
On the one hand, obviously the local nobility, and maybe some even of the gentry if they're rich enough, and then clerics as well. You know, so the court.
Well, the court is anybody in the circle of the king. And
right.
It's enormous.
And it's enormous, and it's constantly changing, which allows for plenty of room for rivalries of who's closest to the king, you know, who gets to sit next to all that stuff.
I think when you say court, you mean that circle slightly educated, as opposed to things that were recited at fairs and street corners.
Yeah.
I think it wouldn't be that kind of.
You're absolutely right. And the thing is also, since the person who wrote this was both in and out at the same time, I mean, it would not, I assume, would not have been himself.
Yeah.
A nobleman and so on. So he's someone who...
Himself or herself.
Or herself.
Don't actually know.
That's true. I'll grant that.
No,
I'll certainly grant that.
Yeah, I
want to be Marie of France wrote this. No. You have people who see what's going on, but they can see it with the advantage of the perspective of being somewhat outside it as well. I mean, if you're a university professor and you suddenly find yourself in Washington among the Pauls, your point of view is going to be a little different from Mitch McConnell if you're somebody who just come up as a country lawyer, become a political power. So you're going to have...
Especially if you're trained to be an entertainer.
Exactly. You know, so you're going to have a different perspective. It's not quite Saturday Night Live. But
So how would these have actually been performed? Would they have been read out to an audience? Would they have been privately read? And I'm thinking that the romance is sort of general. And I'm thinking especially, there's an example in Chaucer, in Troilus and Cressida, where Cressida is reading the Romance of Thebes itself, actually, to a group of her ladies.
That's right, but much earlier in Chrétien's Ivan, there is a woman reading, a girl reading a romance to her parents.
Same with Cressida.
Reading out loud to a larger audience seems to have been the normal way of...
Well, there's a famous image of Chaucer reading to the court, basically.
Yes, there are as many explanations of that picture as there are people who've looked at it.
So
it's clear, in other words, we don't have, and we'll probably never have, an absolutely definitive sense of how these things were performed.
Yeah.
But moments in the Teb where the narration describes a whole bunch of people engaged in debate, like this is something that the author would have, on the one hand, seen, but on the other hand, would enjoy the pleasure of making it up.
It would have just enough basis
in reality that people would say, I've seen that happen. But at the same time, to me at least, the Diaries episode, in addition to very serious issues, has a lot of comedy in it. It's that sense of the outsider
and
inside.
If you were so inclined, you could ham it up as a reading, reading out loud.
Absolutely.
So we have talked about the manuscript. Did you have to make editorial choices? But those were made for you by Jocelyn Logan Brown. So I won't ask that.
Yeah, the basic one of which manuscript we could use. Now, however, and we talk about that a little bit in the introduction, the manuscript S has certain distortions in it. There are passages that are clearly missing.
Uh-huh.
And there are passages that are out of place in manuscript S. There's one episode where the text as we have it, the manuscript, jumps from the middle of one episode to a later one. But later on in the manuscript, we find the passages that should have been there. They've been somehow in a previous reading or compilation, they've been distorted. And this, the unknown scribe of manuscript S, either didn't notice or didn't care or couldn't figure out, but in any case left these things the way they were, so that one of the things that an editor has to do, but it was done for us, in this case it was done by the editor of Manuscript S in the French edition, Francine Morat-Lebrun. She is able to point out in her notes where this goes and actually moves them. And we follow that so that our text, it's all in the manuscript, but we've follow the editor in moving things into their proper place.
Uh-huh. To make more sense.
Exactly. Yeah. So those choices definitely had to be made.
Yeah. And then the language of the manuscript, it's in a medieval form of French. Can you say a few words about the French of the text and its relation to modern French? I mean, is the manuscript in a regional dialect, for instance, or... Well, this is a question I had. Does the form of French differ from older versions of the manuscript to the S version? Because there's quite a number of years between the actual composition of the text and then the S manuscript.
Although, of course, we don't really know when the text, we can only guess when the text was composed.
I'm not the person to ask about this because I don't recognize the dialectical differences. Yeah. I find it accessible in the same way Chrétien de Troyes, Marin France is.
What I'll say, and here again, I'm certainly not an expert. There are five major manuscripts of extant. There obviously were more. It was a popular, it seems to be popular. So of those five, two of them are written in the dialect of what's supposedly of the Île-de-France, of the central French, right? And then the two that are in Picard, from Picardy.
Yes.
And then there's this manuscript, which is the French of England, but underneath it, clearly, an older French, supposedly from the Poitevin area, from the area very near Provence, in Eleanor's realm. So the argument, if you can call it that, is that that's probably where it was originally composed. Mm-hmm. But we don't have a quote-unquote original manuscript. And we try to make that point in the introduction, that that whole notion that you can get back to the original is a very 19th century German desire. It's a search for Eden. It's a search for the Holy Grail of manuscripts. And I think most of us have realized you have to give that up. You can't. It's almost impossible to trace the way in which these manuscripts, because they get put together and fall apart and mice bring holes in them and somebody fills the hole from another manuscript. Every person who puts a hand or a pen to a medieval manuscript is potentially a rewriter of it.
Yeah.
Either by accident, by falling asleep and writing the same line twice or skipping a line, or by design for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So that the whole notion is, it's what the French theorists call mouvance. You cannot expect a medieval French text, or other languages as well, but French what we're talking about, really to be stable from one iteration to another.
Yes.
So that the text that we have, the manuscript S, was written in England, and the French of that betrays in certain ways the so-called French of England, the way French was being written in legal documents and letters and so on in the late 14th century. But underneath it, the forms, some of them at least, reflect an earlier form of French. But again, this is not something we were really charged to do, and I would not want to go on trial to be able to say this. One of the things about the Romance languages in general, I guess, one of the things they have to do is to deal with and finally get rid of the declension systems and the elaborate systems of Latin, you know, which enabled you to put any word anywhere you wanted in a Latin sentence. Yeah. And gradually we got to the point where the word order of a sentence told you what the sentence meant, and so you had to be careful where you put it. In the process, you lose the declension and conjugation endings.
But we do know who owned the manuscript, Henry De Spencer.
Yes.
So what can you tell us about him? Because you do deal with him in the introduction pretty extensively.
Yes, and I should really say, to give credit where it's due, much of what we learned about and wrote about Henry De Spencer, or Le Spencer, was very much influenced by some wonderful primary research done on that by our colleague Christopher Baswell at Barnard and Columbia. Chris, who is a much greater manuscript scholar than I could ever be, and one of the many things I admire about that very admirable man. And so it was his copy of British Library Editional 34114 that we were able to use. He was able to give us a copy. And he had published work on Henry De Spencer. And there's also, of course, the Dictionary of National Biography. And so we did a certain amount of research on our own, but we were very much guided by Baswell's work in this regard. But De Spencer
this
was...
This is the editorial we. Bob did all this. I had nothing to do with this.
De Spencer was a descendant, I guess a grandson, of the two Spencers who were Edward II's buddies who got killed with Edward when Edward was assassinated in 1326 or 27. He was from the north, and his older brother was also a kind of mercenary knight, in a sense, and they ended up, Henry and his older brother, Edward, I guess it was, apparently went to Italy in 1368 with Lionel, one of the sons of Edward III, who was supposed to marry the daughter of the Visconti Dukes of Milan. And he'd soon died, and the Spencers stayed there. And the thought was that he'd been poisoned by the Visconti, if I remember correctly. So The Spencer boys stayed on, and they became fighters for the Pope. They became part of the Pope's army and fought against the Visconti, maybe in revenge. But in any case, if you go to Florence and you go to Santa Maria Novella and you go into the basement and there's wonderful frescoes, there's one fresco in which the older brother has been identified as being there. Anyway, the younger one, through his working for the Pope, he started at a very young age getting clerical privileges, livings. He wasn't a priest, you understand, he'd get the livings. He'd appoint a replacement and get the money. It was a standard way of getting ahead in a certain way. You know, you collected these livings, these prebends and rectories and so on. And only finally later, when he managed to finagle his way into being ordained a bishop, before he could be ordained a bishop, he had to be a priest, so he became a priest. But it was clearly, he was never really interested in the church as a career, except insofar as it gave him power.
Yes.
And he ended up as the Bishop of Norwich, and in the great rising of 1381, he was a major scourge of the rebels.
Yeah.
One of the chroniclers talks about what a wonderful man it was. Before he hung, draw, and quartered the rebels, he blessed them. He gave you a final unction. Off you go, chop, chop, you know. But the main thing that he did, he ran an abortive crusade in 1383.
He stirred it up.
What happened was, of course, that as so happened several times in the course of the Middle Ages, there were rival claimants for the papacy. There was Urban and Clement, and each one had his allies within Europe, so that Clement got the French behind him, and so Urban, of course, the English said, we'll go with the other guy. So that was ridiculous, and Monty Python could have done wonderful things if they wanted to with this. But in any case, Urban, in order to get back at the Clementines and so on, encouraged the English to run a crusade against the French.
Yes, uh-huh.
And this was just what Despenser was looking for. I mean, they didn't call him the battling Bishop of Norwich for nothing. So he conned the Parliament to giving him a lot of money to run this crusade, which was a complete disaster. And he came back in disgrace, and Parliament stripped him of all of his, what are called the temporalities of his episcopacy, meaning all the ways in which he could make money. And it took him several years before he could get those back. So he was in disgrace. Mm-hmm. And he made an enemy of John of Gaunt, because Gaunt wanted to use that same money to go off and run the equivalent of a crusade in Spain, where he had interests. And Parliament decided, no, that the Chemin de France would take precedence over the Chemin de Espagne. So when Le Spencer came back from his aborted crusade with his tail between his legs, Gaunt sort of pounced, and the Parliament turned against him. So he was in disgrace for a while. He went on to have a long career. He, strangely enough, resisted when Henry IV ousted Richard II, just as his grandparents had stayed with Edward II, so the Spencer stayed with Richard II and gotten hot water. But he was bailed out by Henry IV's sister, Philippa, who was the Queen of Portugal at this point. And through the correspondence and the friendship between Henry the Spencer and Philippa, an edition or a manuscript of John Gower's Confessio Amantis ended up in Portuguese, translated into Portuguese, which one of our former students recently went over to a big John of Gower in Portugal conference and has written about it and so on. So he had his fingers in a lot of pies. But in any case, he was a very bellicose guy. And one of the things he did, apparently, was to commission this manuscript, which not only has the Roman de Thèbes in it, but it has several other highly bellicose texts, and is the Aeneas in it as well, or the Roman de Troyes, and a history of chivalry, and so on. Oh, and a poem about the First Crusade. So he was clearly gathering together. Baswell thinks it was done after his disgrace, and it was an attempt to create a mythical alternative, in a sense, because his episcopal shield appears three times in this manuscript, which is how we know that he had something to do with its making.
Okay.
More than you ever wanted to know about Henry the Spencer.
Well, the question is, would the text have been a comfort to him, or at least himself in it?
And that's the sort of person for whom all the action would be.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, yes,
the more hacking each other.
That's true.
The more he would have licked his chops.
Yeah. So your translation, you decided on a line-by-line translation instead of a prose translation, probably for the same reason.
Same reason as the Murray, because the action moves quickly it captures a little better what the poet is doing.
Yeah. And in this we were at odds with the rest of this series, the other volumes in the series, even if the texts in poetry have all been done in prose, so we had to get a sort of special dispensation from Pope Jocelyn.
There was a little back and forth about it, but we
I sometimes prefer a translation that isn't as accurate in poetry rather than in, in rather than prose translations of poetry. I mean, does seem to lose something important. So, so we associate the word romance with narratives of desire. So the question is love courtly love or otherwise an added value here? What role do women play in the story? What role do codes of chivalry play?
You're right, defer to the expert. Yeah.
Well, certainly the courtly love aspect insofar as it's in there. And there's a wonderful passage. In fact, I had thought if we did read anything, I would love to read Antigone's response. So there's a certain amount of added love interest, which goes only so far. But the role of women is important, I think, not just from the romance point of view, but because it reflects a side of medieval life that I've seen more and more in the letters that I've dealt with, which is that women will often play a role in a kind of peacemaking attempt. There are conferences of women organized to arrange certain things politically. Sometimes husbands send their wives. I happen to think it's because the woman can compromise on an issue and the man couldn't without losing face. So he says, well, I've told her to go and that's what she came up with, so we're stuck with it, which may be exactly what he wanted in the first place. So I think Jocasta's role in this reflects that kind of role of women. She's a sensible woman. She tries to balance between the opposing forces.
So she's Oedipus's wife and the mother of the two opposing Polynices and Antiochus, the two warring princes.
And Antigone, of course, is a forceful figure. She also plays the role in the beginning of a young woman who falls in love.
I think also the writer, him or her, she or he, is fully conversant with the emerging or fully emerged conventions of courtly love, of the relationship between love and chivalry, that you're supposed to fight for the love of the woman, and the woman is supposed to encourage you to fight if you really love her, that whole thing. But the poet also sees, as was so often the case, the kinds of possibilities for a kind of rueful comedy in the fact that since it is love we're talking about, people tend to do silly things in love and get into a
Go out without their armor.
Craytown was also very keen on being able to show some of the silly things that people could be driven to. Ultimately, traceable back to Ovid, I mean, who was fully aware of the ridiculousness and necessities of desire, course. But I especially like the way the comic version of that comes at the end of the whole Dares episode, which we've been sort of dancing around here, which is the great moment on the one hand in which the tensions of loyalty that we talked about earlier. You know, Dares is a baron of Eteocles. He controls one of the seven towers of Thebes, so he's in a very important position in warfare. His son is captured by the other side, by Polynices, by the invading side, and they send the son back to the father with a promise that he'll return to say, if you ever want to see me free again, you've got to turn over your tower to the invading army. And of course, his wife says, of course you're going to do this, jerk. And Dares says, no, I can't do it because I'll... So the way he finally has to figure this out, he has to find a way to have his loyalty to the king, to Eteocles, dissolved in such a way that he can say, okay, I am now free to do what I want, which in this case is to save my son, even if it means betraying my city. And of course, he does that, and it doesn't work out finally. That is, that Eteocles, the king, is able to have an engineer who undermines the tower, and it collapses once it's been taken over by the invaders, and they all get killed. And Dares is then in a situation where the king has said, okay, you betrayed me, I'm now going to have you drawn and quartered and hanged and slung. And his lords, many of whom are the kin, who have another kind of relationship to Dares, say, no, not so fast. You're going to do this, you've got to do it legally. We, the barons, have to try him. Which is also, by the way, an interesting point, because one of the things that the kings of the 12th and into the 13th century constantly had to worry about was what to do with their rebellious barons. One whole part of the Chanson de Gestes, right? The gest of the rebellious barons. So a king had to find a way to simultaneously save his own authority, but at the same time recognize the rights of the barons so they didn't rebel against them. And that's the point that's being made here. Some of the barons saying, no, no, you can't just decide you got to kill this guy. Yeah. You have to let us decide whether you should do it. And of course, the king doesn't like that at all because he's afraid, rightly so, that they'll find a way to try to get their relative off. So all the tensions are there. And there's this long scene, over 1,000 lines, in which they just argue back and forth.
It's a legal argument. For me, it's the heart of the text. Yeah,
they're legal arguments. On the one hand, they're legal arguments and very real ones. Yeah. On the other hand, as a performance, it's very much a clerical performance. It's rhetorical, how you can make an argument work on both sides and how you can... And that all comes out of Rome, and that's of Seneca the Elder's Controversiae. You need a whole tradition that you trained young men to be able to argue both sides of any issue, right?
And the interesting thing is,
forensic culture.
The narrator tells you exactly what's happened just before this, and it even gives you the thought processes of Derry's, why he's doing this.
Right.
And then you get the barons describing what he's done and conflicting descriptions.
Right, of course, they're all good lawyers. They're making the case for the best. Yeah. But, and of course, the way it then ends...
Finally, it is resolved, not by arguments,
but by bringing in the love... Which on the one hand...
So marriage is...
Right, on the one hand, gets into this whole question of love and so on. But also, I see it, you may not agree, as very funny, in the sense that all that argument, all that male puffery and so on, but as soon as you hear that the king has a lech for Darius' daughter, as I was thinking about it yesterday, it was a perfect analogy. It's a Monty Python routine in which apparently there was in the 60s, 70s England, and places like Brighton, and when the people of the lower middle classes would go to the seaside for the summer, and to while their time away, there would be competitions at the shore, contests. Mm-hmm. And so this is a seaside competition in summarizing A la recherche de temps perdu of Proust, and so they have this carnival barker saying, now we're going to have this contest, and various people come up, and of course they all fail miserably. There's one group that tries to present a summary of the A la recherche de temps perdu. It's a madrigal. Proust in his first book, summarize, and somebody else, and so this goes on, and they all sort of fast, and then the carnival barker boy says, and now we're going to award the prize and summarize, and of course it goes to the girl with the biggest tits. And that's exactly, I think, what's happening at this point. Yeah. See, it undercuts the whole thing.
Yeah. Discourse of Desire is the term I remember.
Another aspect to the love interest is the two sisters.
Yes.
Antigone and...
Ismena.
They are in love with people on opposite sides of the fighting, and so they watch the fighting, and they suffer in different ways, and although it's treated in a slightly frivolous, romantic teenage kind of language, nonetheless, I think it's indicative of the kind of things that happen to women.
I couldn't agree more with that. At the bottom, there's a very serious issue there, which we still see all the stories about World War II and how women suffer when stupid men go off and fight. They're the ones who end up suffering in a special way.
And then, of course, women in the end end the romance altogether, don't they? And that women of Greece come with hammers and beat down the walls.
Tear down the walls,
Do tear down the walls.
Yes, they do tear down the walls. Except it's also, what is it, Theseus's machines of war also bang a hole in the walls. But there's no question that the notion of the desperation at having lost all their men.
Yeah. I didn't have you actually read from the text. I don't know if you have favorite passages you might want to read.
I thought was sort of fun. It's where Antigone is first approached by Partenope, who's making love to her, and she's very attracted to him, but she also has this sense that she can't do anything because of her lineage and her family, and they have to ascertain that he is appropriate before she can accept him. It's kind of charming, I think. It's line 42-41. Is 20 lines too long?
No, okay. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Par Dieu, si on respond la pucelle, cette amour serait trop isnelle. Pucelle suit, fille de ré, légèrement amère, ne dé amère par lècherie, dont l'on puisse dire folie. Ici d'être l'on prière berchère, et ses autres femmes légères. Ne vous connois mais ne vous vit, ne mais or que vos vessies. Ce or vos donne d'amère parole, bien me poète tenir pour folle. Pour ce nous dit, solaire nos cœur, ne vous seus fort mon cher, si est-ce de tel linage que vous fuissiez de mon parage, et sauf fût chose destinée, que vous fût à femme donnée.
car belles estes sur toute gent, onc ne vi mais homme tangent. So she says she really finds him very attractive, and if he's the right lineage she can certainly accept him, but otherwise, she's barely met him, she says, this is the way you treat shepherdesses or other women of that sort, but not women like me. It's a sort of
passage.
Charming.
It's a wonderful passage.
It gives you an idea of how beautiful the language is, too. There's so much to it, and it reminds me of a Hollywood action film, almost to a point where the fighting is going to take over the plot. There's so much of it. It all has a purpose in the end. But the passage of the Battle of the Geezers. The Old Guys, was an interesting passage, because the old men.
Putting their white beards out, exactly. Yes. It is interesting to see how the poem follows but then doesn't follow the stacious plot. I mean, there are certain larger arcs, obviously, going toward the Thebes and the Battle of Thebes and the destruction that causes. And there's a great deal of pathos in the latter part as one or another of the heroes that you've become quite attached to in some way, especially on the Polynices side, Hippomenon and others, and end up, you don't expect it, and suddenly they're dead too.
They seem to be winning right up to the end.
And then there's that wonderfully pathetic moment when two young brothers who are on opposite sides, just matching the idea of the two sisters, two brothers on opposite, kill each other. Yeah. And of course, that's such a macabre foreshadowing, if you will, a prolepsis of what's going to happen at the end, where Eteocles and Polynices kill each other. Yeah. And then that horrible moment, they can't, even when you try to bury them, they fight each other after death. That sense of a kind of implacable hatred, which has overcome all possible fraternal love. I mean, you know, again, it's the idea that when finally the chips are down, the lust for power is going to overcome everything else, which is a very sad, you know, and again, at the risk of trivializing, it's like House of Cards, both the English and the American versions. Politics is finally all about power. Anything else finally is going to give way to the naked desire to have more power and most power.
Or to hang on to it.
And to hang on to it once you've got it for dear life. Yeah. The comedy is there, the pathos is there. Yeah. Finally, at the bottom or the top or whatever, is this kind of understanding. It's stripped of any kind of martial heroic coloring, and maybe that's because it's written by someone who is him or herself not of that class, but could have been a very humble. There's a wonderful phrase that one of the 12th century chroniclers uses to describe the people who running the administrations of Henry I and therefore of Henry II as well, people themselves who became absolutely essential to the running of this court, keeping the records, collecting the taxes, who were themselves, they'd been to school one way or the village school or monastery school, but were themselves of low birth. The phrase that's used by the chronicler is men raised from the dust. So this may have been a man or woman raised from the dust, and what he or she finally sees is that power, strip away all the other stuff, good and bad, it's the naked desire for power that leads those two men to be fighting with each other, even these two brothers to be fighting even to their... And it's not an accident also that we see them at the very beginning stomping on Oedipus's eyeballs. When it's that notion of power and blindness of power. It's there. I mean, it's brilliant in its own way.
Last question for both of you, or either. Do you have any future writing projects?
I will do that. As my husband says, you're lucky enough to have a project that will outlive you.
I can't say that. Well, I recently finished a fairly substantial comparative study of the Decameron and the Canterbury Tales.
I'll have to come back and we'll have to do an interview for
Is different, I hope, at least, and I think, from anything else that's been done, because it has no real interest in whether Chaucer knew Boccaccio, whether Chaucer depended. It's really an attempt to treat purely in a coordinative way, a comparative study of these two great, nearly contemporary story collections. What led these two collections to come into being? What are the cultural implications and imperatives that led these story collections, which I then argue have certain, not even themes, but impulses, shared impulses underneath them that then exfoliate. And the fact is, if there is a similar underlying, as I argue, impulse or theme, you choose a story collection so that you can show the many, many, many different ways that this thing plays itself out, to respect what both authors understood was the incredible variety of human situations
they
needs.
That's totally true.
So that's, I finished that, and I'm now at work on a project involving my grandfather and my uncle. My grandfather emigrated to this country from Sicily in the late 19th century, and one of his children, my uncle, went on to become an executive in the motion picture business. And I like the idea of two generations, one generation which gave up everything in order to come to and find America, and his son spent a whole career out of America selling a version of America to the world that never existed. So it seems to be there's a kind, so I'm trying to work on something like that.
Okay, so I'd like to thank you both immensely for spending
so
much time.
It's wonderful to see you and have a chance
to chat.
Yeah, same here. And to talk about your book, The Roman de Thèbes, The Romance of Thebes, published by the Arizona Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies just last year. Thanks very much.